Today is Tuesday, August 6th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington, and coming up...
Right now, the tensions are at a high peak because the meetings did not go well last week, and President Trump says he's going to impose 10% additional tariffs on China starting September 1st.
That was international trade expert Gary Huffbauer talking about the rising trade tensions between Washington and Beijing. Also ahead, U.S. Defense Secretary Mark Esper says the U.S. intends to prevent any unilateral incursion by Turkey into northern Syria. The U.N. High Commissioner for Human Rights is endorsing strong gun control measures in the U.S., and American Nobel Prize-winning author Toni Morrison dies at the age of 88. It's all on today's International Edition. Well, U.S. President Donald Trump says he will impose a 10% tariff on $300 billion worth of goods imported from China because he says Beijing hasn't met its promise to buy more U.S. agricultural products. He also accused China of manipulating its currency after the yuan fell against the dollar Monday. The terror threat rattled financial and commodity markets around the world yesterday. Gary Huffbauer studies international trade at the Peterson Institute of International Economics right here in Washington. He spoke with my colleague, Kate Pound Dawson, about the rising trade tensions between Washington and Beijing.
It's extremely unsettled. No one knows exactly how this is going to play out, but right now the tensions are at a high peak because the meetings did not go well last week, and President Trump then says he's going to impose 10% additional tariffs on China starting September 1st, and China has said that it will retaliate. So this is on top of all the trade tensions so far, which now will cover almost all of U.S. imports from China after September 1st. So that's pretty big. And all U.S. exports to China will be covered by various tariffs and trade retaliation by the Chinese. So this is unprecedented and is very unsettling to the to all the markets, both the financial markets and the real markets. And on top of that, today, President Trump has said that the Chinese are manipulating the yuan, the RMB, their currency. It's devalued. Most economists would say that as a result of the trade tensions, one would expect the yuan to devalue against the dollar, but President Trump sees this as manipulation, China trying to seek an advantage in world trade through a cheaper currency. So that's added more fuel to the fire.
Right now, the U.S. economy is still doing pretty well. China's economy has been slowing down. It's been slowing for a couple of years compared with a decade ago when it routinely had GDP growth of 10%. How much are the trade tensions affecting the economies of the two countries?
Well, I think they're having a pretty big effect. We won't really know until the econometrics are done, after the fact. But you saw that the U.S. second quarter GDP growth was 2.1%. In my view, it would have been up near 2.8% without the conflicts that we're having, because the trade conflicts have reduced U.S. exports to China. But they've also increased the value of the dollar against all other currencies, and that's reduced U.S. exports to the rest of the world as well. And so when we take the export hit, that's one thing, but business confidence was also down pretty sharply in the second quarter, and business investment was down. So that's been the penalty on the U.S. in just that one quarter. I think over a period of a year, the impact on the U.S. will be a decline or a loss of growth of about two-tenths of 1%. Maybe that doesn't sound so great, but to economists, 0.2% on the giant U.S. economy is pretty big stuff. Now, China, the effect in as a percent of its economy is larger. And the best estimates I've seen suggest that China has lost about 0.5% of growth up to the trade wars as of last week. Now, this additional conflict may increase that number. In other words, worsen the Chinese outlook by 0.5%.
How big of a spillover effect will this dispute between two countries have in the greater global economy?
Well, again, it will be substantial. The International Monetary Fund is suggesting that the slowdown in world economic growth as a result of the trade conflicts could be as large as 0.5%. That's a lot. That's a lot. And it is having a spillover for the reasons you say. Financial markets are down. Business confidence is really taking a hit. I mean, you know, if you're a executive of a large business firm, are you going to go forward with that investment now, the big investment, the $1-3 billion investment, or are you going to wait and see? Well, a lot of businessmen are waiting and seeing.
That was Gary Huffbauer, a non-resident fellow at the Peterson Institute, speaking with VOA's Kate Pound Dawson. Among the top stories in the world, Russian President Vladimir Putin called yesterday for urgent arms control talks amid concerns for a new arms race. North Korea launched another round of short-range ballistic missiles into the sea today and warned it could take a new road in response to U.S.-South Korea military exercises. Indonesia's capital was hit by a 9-hour blackout, triggering demands for alternative power sources. Russia complained to the Japanese ambassador today in the latest flap about disputed islands. And Libya says 3 airstrikes on a town hall meeting killed at least 42 people and wounded 60 more. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on the VOAnews.com website and on our VOA mobile app. This is VOA's International Edition. Well, the United Nations is voicing alarm at the renewed flare-up of fighting in northwestern Syria after a lull of 3 days. Aid agencies report hostilities, including airstrikes across northern Hama, southern Idlib, and western Aleppo governance, once again have reached fever pitch. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
Some 3 million civilians in Idlib and surrounding areas are trapped in the violence, a third of whom are children. The UN Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs reports the situation for everyone is dire, especially for children. Syrian government forces, backed by their Russian allies, have been mounting a ferocious military offensive to retake Idlib, the last rebel stronghold in Syria. OCHA spokesman Jens Laerke says many of the children caught in this maelstrom have known nothing but war.
Our emergency relief coordinator, Mark Lowcock, spoke last week via video link to some of them, and they told him that they were afraid, they were displaced, and they and their schools were being bombed, and they just wanted the bombing to stop. If the desperate voices of these children have any value or carry any weight, then more shelling, more airstrikes and more violence is the wrong answer.
The United Nations reports 440,000 people are displaced in Idlib province, and at least 450 civilians, many of them children, have been killed since late April. Laerke says a lot of critical infrastructure, schools, hospitals, markets, places of worship, have been bombed during this period. He tells VOA some of the hospitals have been bombed after coordinates designating the location of these facilities were shared with the Russians and Syrians.
We have operated a deconfliction mechanism. There's been a lot of debate about the effectiveness of that mechanism, whether it actually protects health facilities in particular. It is an open question, frankly, whether this mechanism should and will continue.
Laerke says the United Nations is consulting with its NGO partners on whose behalf it provides those details to the warring parties. Whether or not the program continues, he notes international humanitarian law deems the targeting of medical facilities under any circumstances to be a war crime. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Thank you, Lisa. U.S. Defense Secretary Mark Esper says the U.S. intends to prevent any unilateral incursion by Turkey into northern Syria. Hundreds of U.S. troops are stationed east of the Euphrates River in northern Syria, working with the Syrian Democratic Forces. An incursion by Turkey could put them in the middle of a firefight between Turkish and Kurdish forces. Esper says the U.S. is trying to work out an arrangement that addresses Turkey's concerns, adding, "I'm hopeful we'll get there." He did not provide details on whether progress is being made. VOA senior analyst Mohammed El-Shenawi spoke with Michael O'Hanlon, senior fellow and director of research at the Foreign Policy Program of the Brookings Institute, about prospects of a confrontation between U.S. and Turkey and options to avoid escalation.
Well, I don't think there's going to be a confrontation because I don't think the United States, frankly, cares enough to fight Turkey to prevent them from some kind of an incursion. And I doubt that Turkey is really anxious for that kind of risk itself. You could imagine the relationship taking a major turn for the worse above and beyond what's already happened if things go badly. But I think what Secretary Esper probably is getting at is that we're going to certainly work hard to prevent that, because it's in our interest to keep those ISIS prisoners in the hands of Syrian Kurds who have done so much to liberate northeastern Turkey and who now guard them. And also, we feel a certain amount of gratitude and debt towards those Kurds for what they did to defeat ISIS. So I think Esper is going to work hard to prevent the scenario of a Turkish incursion, but I don't think that extends to the use of American military force in direct opposition against Turkey.
Esper said the U.S. is trying to work out an arrangement that addresses Turkey's concerns, adding, "I am hopeful we will get there," and he didn't provide any detail on where progress is being made. What are the prospects of reaching an arrangement that could prevent a confrontation?
Well, I think there are reasonable prospects for compromise. I think the United States could keep roughly the number of forces that it has today in Syria, but perhaps concentrate them in the border area and almost act as a third-party peacekeeping force, and also help limit the movement of people and weaponry across the Syrian-Turkish border. Because, as we all know, the Turks view the Kurdish forces on both sides of the border as united and unified and all essentially part of the PKK, and therefore willing to use violence against Turkey itself. And so the Turks see any of these Kurds as essentially violent opposition fighters. And the only thing the United States could do to mitigate that concern is to limit the movement across the border of people and supplies and money and things like that. So perhaps we could be involved in a patrolling. It would not be perfect for the Turks or the Kurds, especially for the Turks. They would still worry that this would grant a sanctuary to certain Kurdish fighters on Syrian soil. But I think that's the sort of path forward that we might be able to reach. And this would, of course, require some adjustment in President Trump's preference to get all the U.S. forces out of Syria. But if he could confine those forces to the border area, perhaps he could still declare that a victory. Those are the only real levers that I believe we have here. And so we'll have to see if there's a compromise that's possible.
The Syrian Democratic Forces has been America's main partner on the ground against the Islamic State group, and the Kurds are currently detaining thousands of foreign fighters. U.S. officials worry that those fighters could get free during a Turkish incursion into the Kurdish-held territory. How serious is such a threat?
Oh, I think the threat is quite serious, because if you are a Kurdish fighter, a Syrian Democratic Force fighter, but also a Kurd, and you feel that you've helped liberate your territory from ISIS, and now you've got some degree of safety because at the moment, Assad is not attacking, ISIS is not attacking, and the Turks are not attacking, but you have three potential enemies in that area, and the United States and its partners have helped you up until now to have the weaponry needed to defeat ISIS and then to maintain some degree of control over that territory. That's the current situation. But the minute that Turkey comes in, to that territory with large combat forces and has the intention of major military operations against Syrian Kurdish forces, that whole balance goes away. And all of a sudden, if you're a Kurd, you're fighting for your life. This time, you're fighting against Turkey. And therefore, you don't have the luxury to devote forces to holding ISIS fighters. You know, it's already going to be a lopsided fight with the Turkish military and all of its resources available to come in and punish the Syrian Kurds. And I don't see how they could possibly be expected to guard ISIS forces under those circumstances. So I think it's sort of a zero-sum situation where if the Turks come in, more ISIS fighters go free. And that's why Secretary Esper is so concerned.
That was Michael O'Hanlon, Senior Fellow and Director of Research at the Foreign Policy Program of the Brookings Institution, speaking with VOA Senior Analyst Mohammed El-Shenawi. While the United Nations High Commissioner for Human Rights, Michelle Bachelet, has condemned the two mass shootings that claimed the lives of at least 31 people in the U.S. this week, Bachelet endorsed strong gun control measures to preempt such attacks. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
The United Nations Human Rights Office warns hate crimes appear to be on the rise in the United States, noting an increase in violent attacks against synagogues, mosques, churches, and LGBT people. The UN says these attacks in one way or another are rooted in racism, xenophobia, intolerance, discrimination, and white supremacy. It says people in positions of authority have to be careful about what they say because words matter. The spokesman for the UN High Commissioner, Rupert Colville, says authorities are responsible for ensuring their actions do not promote negative stereotypes that lead to violent outbursts, as happened in the U.S. states of Texas and Ohio.
We're concerned that these types of messages not only stigmatize and dehumanize minorities, migrants, refugees, women, LGBT, and the so-called other, but they also leave targeted persons and communities vulnerable to the risks of reprisals and attacks. And that applies to any authority anywhere.
3 years ago, in the wake of the mass killing of 49 people in a gay nightclub in Orlando, Florida, the previous High Commissioner for Human Rights, Zayd Raad al-Hussein, urged Washington to ban assault weapons and adopt other arms control measures to preempt further killings. Colville says the current High Commissioner, Michelle Bachelet, fully endorses his statement.
He called specifically on the United States to live up to its obligations to protect its citizens from the, and I quote, horrifyingly commonplace but preventable violent acts that are the direct result of insufficient gun control.
Colville tells VOA it is too easy to attribute gun violence to mental illness. He says mental illness may be a factor in some cases, but not all. He says there are many reasons why people resort to violence, such as blind hatred for a particular group or criminality. If assault rifles are available, the UN spokesman says, there is a risk that people will use them. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
A series of mass shootings over the past several days in the United States has again revived talk about changing U.S. laws to reduce gun violence. It is a hotly debated topic in the country, with proponents for restricting gun access often facing off with organizations such as the National Rifle Association, or NRA, which advocates for gun ownership. VOA's Kate Pound-Dawson spoke with Chris Brown, president of Brady, an organization that urges lawmakers around the country to pass new laws on gun ownership. She opens the conversation by talking about what her organization sees as practical approaches.
The reality is this is far too common in America. We have almost as many mass shootings in 2019 as we have days. And the reality is the solutions to stop this kind of violence are right before us. Things like an assault weapons ban and high-capacity magazines. If you're focusing on Dayton and El Paso, there's a common theme here. One is inspired by hate, both of them. The second is assault weapons and high-capacity magazines. So at Brady, we're very straightforward about what we think the solutions are. We think we need to expand the Brady background check system. We need to have an assault weapons ban and high-capacity magazine restriction as the law of the land, in other words, a federal law like we had for 10 years that Congress allowed to sunset. And President Trump mentioned this in his speech today. We need extreme risk laws. Those are the laws that about 15 states have passed that allow law enforcement and family members to seek a court order to temporarily remove guns from individuals who are at risk of harm to themselves or others. We have an epidemic, so we need a multi-pronged approach, and we should start there.
There has long been an argument in the United States that because there's reference to the right to bear arms in the U.S. Constitution, in the Second Amendment, that that creates a special situation. And there are people who say that because of that constitutional, it's a few short words, because of those words in the Constitution, it's not legal to regulate weapons and guns in any way. How do organizations like yours address that argument and sort of explain that there might be a middle ground between no regulation and some regulation?
Well, the Second Amendment, like all of the amendments to our Constitution, is not absolute. There's not a single constitutional scholar, there's not even a single member of the Supreme Court, living or dead, who would agree that the amendments in the Constitution are absolute and without limit. Even Antonin Scalia, in his opinions, including the Heller decision, noted the kinds of restrictions that might be appropriate with respect to guns. So we have to start there. It's not an unlimited right, and that's just clear and set forth in the Constitution. It's also helpful to remember it starts with a well-armed militia, and that's a big part of the interpretation. The kinds of things that I've talked about here, assault weapons bans, restrictions on high-capacity magazines, expansion of the Brady background check system, extreme risk laws, those laws are in effect in many states across this country. And believe me, because the NRA exists, they are well litigated. Every court that's looked at this issue has upheld those kinds of measures as constitutional. And you only need go back to think about the restrictions in place even when the Second Amendment was adopted, in which reasonable restrictions were enforced, even inspections of individuals' homes to ensure that their guns were safely stored. So that's always been inherent as part of really the American experience, along with a notion that had existed for a very long time that I think we've strayed from, which is guns are a tool, but they also pose potential danger, both to the owner and those who live in the homes where the guns are. And so ultimately what we have to go back to, what we really want to talk about or should be talking about if we want to fix a lot of these problems, is what responsible gun ownership really looks like in this country. And what Brady is trying to do is really foster conversations to include gun owners and non-gun owners about the kind of America in which we want to live.
That was Chris Brown, president of the group Brady, formerly known as the Brady Center to Prevent Gun Violence. She spoke with my colleague, Kate Pound Dawson. Well, on a sad note, American Nobel Prize-winning author Toni Morrison has died. Her publisher confirmed she died last night at a medical center in New York. Morrison was born in Lorain, Ohio, and she broke many barriers during her lifetime. She became the first black woman to win a Nobel Prize in Literature in 1993 for her novels. Over her six-decade career, she wrote 11 novels, 5 children's books, a song cycle, 2 plays, and an opera. Morrison was 88. You've been listening to International Edition. You can find us at voanews.com. Thanks for joining us, and thanks to our director, Nadia Taha, engineer, Thomas Blondet. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.